Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show. Fox Sports Radio. Coming to you live and direct from sunny, blazing hot Los Angeles, California. Hope you're having a great day, man. So, today's kind of a weird day, right? We had no playoff basketball yesterday. We do tonight. We got college baseball in a way. We have, what is that called? Euro Cup? Is that what it is? Euro Cup? Euro Cup taking place. We got Major League Baseball taking place. And then, of course, we have the NBA playoffs. Game 2, Western Conference Finals tonight, which is weird because the Eastern Conference Finals have not yet even begun. That said, here we go. Away we go. And we have ourselves a mystery. What was your favorite cartoon as a kid? Favorite cartoon? I'll give you a couple of mine. I liked the Roadrunner, but I really liked the Roadrunner with Wile E. Coyote, Super Genius. You guys remember that? It's not just when he was Wile E. Coyote, he was Wile E. Coyote, Super Genius. Remember that version of Wile E. of the Roadrunner? It's amazing. And when I say I liked cartoons as a kid, I'm underselling it. I really am. Because my generation, right? My generation, yes, we had video games, but I didn't really have the Intellivision, ColecoVision. Like my first real video game system, I think we might have had one of the, I think we had Atari before that with Pong and with, what was the tank game? I can't remember. Maybe it was called Tank. Anyway, it didn't dominate my life until it became the Nintendo Super System, right? That's when you had The Legend of Zelda and Super Mario Brothers and Double Dribble and Blades of Steel. So because I had a good window of 12 years or so of childhood before those things hit my brain, the video games hit my brain, I'd come home or go to a friend's house, and literally every day after school, I would watch Heathcliff. I would watch Gummy Bears. Was Gummy Bears, I think, was Saturday morning. Right? I wasn't a Smurfs guy. I wonder if it's because I loved Scooby-Doo. Right? Because Scooby-Doo was a mystery. And if it wasn't for those meddling kids, people would have gotten away from it. Gotten away with it. Right? Well, we're going to be those meddling kids today. We have a mystery. We have a conundrum. We have a question. Want to know what it is? Who was Tom Brady talking about when he talked trash about a team that he felt like backed away from the table? When he was looking in free agency at a new team. This is what he said. This is what Tom Brady said on the Shop.
One of the teams, and they weren't interested at the very end. I was thinking, you're sticking with that mother...
Oh, you're sticking with that mother... By the way, like, post-Super Bowl Tom Brady has far and away been the most enjoyable Tom Brady of our lives. Previously, Tom Brady, remember, he's just too damn good-looking, too rich, too rigid, too stiff, too New England for the rest of the world to truly buy into. But then he gets tanked at the victory parade. Then he goes on the Shop and starts talking trash. Then he changes kind of his tune of trash talk, getting ready for this big golf showdown. And you're like, you know what? I kind of dig this guy. Who is he talking about? Okay, the teams that we know Tom Brady was at least interested in, or we were told, was Miami, Tampa, Chicago, the Chargers, and the Niners. And to be honest with you, it's, by my estimation, a pretty easy mystery to solve. Right? It's really pretty easy mystery to solve. We can eliminate Tampa because he went there. We can eliminate Miami. Hey, eliminate Miami because Miami did not pull away. He decided against Miami. And I believe we can pull away from the Chargers because though they had Tyrod Taylor, they had, you know, after Tom Brady changed his tune and decided to not go, they went and drafted Justin Herbert, which was kind of part of their plan, but we didn't know until Tom Brady made his decision. It leaves us really with San Francisco and the Bears. And while the Bears and Mitchell Trubisky feel like they're the obvious answer, I think it's got to be Jimmy Garoppolo. My logic behind it is the Bears would have moved mountains to get Tom Brady. Would he have fit their offense? Probably not. Did they have the best personnel? No, they did not. Could they have protected him as he's a bit of a statue back there? Sure. There wasn't really a meeting of the minds with Matt Nagy and his offensive style, though he has been well respected, despite the fact that they haven't been seen as a stunning success in Chicago. Remember that the thing we've learned about all of these quarterbacks, right, from Aaron Rodgers to Russell Wilson to Tom Brady, all of these guys, is they may appear to be nice guys and genuine guys and thoughtful guys, great leaders and bright guys. But at the end of the day, you can't be this successful in sports unless you're an absolute killer as a competitor. And a killer as a competitor, it believes beyond any reasonable doubt that they are, in fact, the best at what they do. Otherwise, you can't be the best at what you do. And that competitive instinct, to me, says Tom Brady, it wasn't just he wanted to go to his hometown Niners, the team he dreamed of playing with, but he also wanted to see Jimmy Garoppolo be sent packing. Why? Because Jimmy Garoppolo was the guy that he sent packing originally. He wanted to be that guy that's constantly sending Jimmy Garoppolo to another team. That's why he was so snide. And oh yeah, by the way, he's seen Jimmy Garoppolo up close. He knows exactly what Garoppolo has, and he doesn't respect it. This is more educated guess than anything. Chicago is a reasonable guess, but the difference is I don't believe Chicago ever pulled out and ever was not interested. And even though Mitchell Trubisky is not nearly as good nor as well respected as Garoppolo, I think it was Garoppolo and the Niners, because even the Niners, by their own admission, said they kicked the tires, they thought about it, and they decided to stick with Jimmy G. The Niners have told you the answer. We know that he doesn't dig Garoppolo. It's reasonable to believe that he would want to inflict pain on Garoppolo and send him packing yet again. And we know that the Niners pulled out of the Tom Brady Derby by their own accord. Tom Brady might have gotten away with it if it wasn't for this meddling kid. That's the way I look at it. Ramos, you agree? You disagree? Discuss.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, I do think that there's this little bit of an itch behind Tom Brady for the whole Jimmy G thing that went down in New England. And, of course, yeah, that all of your points come to that one conclusion for me as well, yes.
Gavin, do you think it's Chicago instead?
I lean a little more towards Chicago, because the Niners were just in the Super Bowl, and I think it's a little hard to take a shot like that, even though we all know that it was the team mostly and Kyle Shanahan that got them there, not just Jimmy G. And then the other thing, there is the Don Yee thing, where they share the same agent. Would he take a shot like that?
Hmm.
But he's Tom Brady, so he's unpredictable. So... he definitely seems like he is in his, he's just, you know, no one can say anything bad about him. He's out of New England. He doesn't have the restraints on him anymore. He can say whatever he wants. So nothing would surprise me.
What about you, Dan Beyer? What do you which team do you think it is?
I thought Bears. I still thought Raiders maybe. But Niners is an option. I still don't know. I'm still confused. And I even went back to try to look. Okay, what was the timeline with Chicago for when Brady signed with Tampa, when the Bears acquired Nick Foles as part of that deal? Because if Brady was saying that, was the Foles deal done beforehand, which would eliminate the Bears? So I'm still kind of up in the air. But I think that the Raiders still could have been a possibility as well. But
be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Matthew Wolf joins us on the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Matthew, how are you?
I'm great, yeah. Thank you for having me.
What was that back nine like on Sunday? Because to those of us sitting at home with a cold one enjoying Father's Day, it looked rough. What was Torrey South like on Sunday on that back nine?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, U.S. Open's the hardest test in golf, and obviously coming down the stretch, they're trying to make it as hard as possible. So, yeah, just really hard conditions, you know. Everything firmed out, so, you know, it was so hard, it was so much harder to hit the fairways, and then once you did, I mean, it was still hard to get it close to all those pins because, you know, you were just coming in with such long clubs, and, you know, to kind of witness what John did, too, was pretty amazing. You know, I think he played a really solid round all day, but those two putts on those last two holes as left-to-right swingers, I mean, you have to have amazing touch in order to just make those with no pressure, and with all the pressure that he had, I mean, it was pretty cool to see him step up at that big of a time.
Yeah, no, it's really amazing, especially considering, you know, what he went through when he popped positive for COVID. What's your approach been like during these times in which you knew you're going to be tested, and there's so much question as to how you get through these protocols? What has your approach been like?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing much I can do. The PGA Tour has set up amazing guidelines, and USGA was the same way. They set up great guidelines for all of us to, you know, feel like we could have a good time and be free and not worry about COVID, as well as following all the rules that they have in place of, you know, just, you know, isolating ourselves or, you know, staying away from everyone else. And it's been a while since it's really felt normal. But, you know, like I said, they've been doing an unbelievable job of letting us play and giving us that freedom. And, you know, as well as all the fans out there, you know, I felt like this was the first week back that I was, you know, those roars were a lot louder than I remember them last time there were fans out here.
It's Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. That's the voice of Matthew Wolf, of course, PGA golfer. And the Travelers Championship is one of the events that I've been to, right, up in Connecticut. And, you know, the stadium hole, I'm not going to say it's Phoenix, but they're Connecticut folks, the Nutmeg State, they kind of want to be Phoenix of the Northeast. Is it fair to at least mention it in the Phoenix variety in terms of the relative rowdiness of the past?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see the past champions of the Travelers. You know, it's a great list of people, and you know, I feel like there's been some very exciting finishes, and that has to do with, you know, the players hitting really good shots, but as well as just the course that, you know, it sets up so amazing for it. The par five, I think it's the 13th hole, is a great par five that you can make a birdie or eagle on and, you know, maybe jump a couple spots up closer to the lead. And then obviously 15 through 17 is just an unbelievable stretch where you can, you know, go two under and gain a bunch of shots or, you know, make a mistake and hit it in the water. So I just think that course sets up for such an exciting finish. And on top of that, you know, the fans here are, you know, they really love us, you know, coming here and playing the tournament, and they're so supportive, and they just, you know, they have such a good time, which makes us have such a good time. So it's a great atmosphere.
No question. Hunter Mahan's a buddy of mine. Obviously, he's also an OSU guy, and I mean, he's kind of deity status up there. Like does he blow you off when you get to Connecticut because he thinks he's so big time once he gets up there?
No, actually, it's funny you say that. I saw Hunter this morning, and I was going up to my room in the elevator, and he just got out. He was heading to the course, and you know, his hair was still had all the flow in the world, and, you know, he looked good. But, yeah, he said hi, and we just kind of passed and said, you know, hope you have a good week. And but, yeah, no, I haven't – he's definitely not one that I've talked to a lot out here, but he's definitely said hi and, you know, reached out and said if I ever need anything, he's here. So it's nice to have OSU connection as well.
Obviously, look, you played the juniors. You played in plenty of big tournaments. This is the place where you made your debut as a pro. What, and that was just 2 years ago. What's that experience like of the first time you're technically a professional, right? You played in big events, played in PGA events, but now all of a sudden you're a pro. What is that actual experience like of teeing it up officially as one?
Yeah, it was, you know, a great experience. I think I was probably the most nervous I've been up to date, you know, when I was making my pro debut here, because, you know, coming out of college, I played really well, and, you know, everything was, you know, a lot of high expectations, and coming out here and got a sponsor's exemption. So I was, you know, maybe putting a little bit of pressure on myself to play well. And, you know, it was definitely probably one of the highest pressure situations, even just teeing off on the first tee. But it was also one of the most fulfilling and just, like, you know, memorable. You know, this is what I had dreamed of since I was a little kid. And, you know, I worked really hard and made my way up through every single rank. And, you know, to finally step up on that first tee as, you know, teeing it up in my first pro tournament was definitely fulfilling.
Yeah. And then like a month later, you won your first tournament. What, you know, and you shoot a 65 and you probably have thinking like, this is cake, dude. Like I've been in this a month. I already win one. The night before, how did you process like sleeping, resting, you know, cause I've talked to a couple guys and they're like, it's just so different when it's Sunday and you're leading or Sunday and you're close and it's a PGA, like, you know, and again, like you said, you've been doing it your whole life, but an event, what allowed you to play so well and shoot a 65 in Minnesota and win that 3M, which is your first ever win going back 2 years ago?
Yeah, my first and my only to date. That win at 3M was unbelievable. I think, you know, just that Saturday night before, I definitely made sure to be talking to, you know, my friends and my family and just kind of not take my mind off of golf, but just, you know, like ease the nerves and anxiety a little bit, because, you know, when you're in that position, especially that soon out of college, it's, you know, you're anxious. You're like, I just want to get out there. I want to, you know, go win or do the best I can and just see what happens, because you don't want to wait. And, you know, I made sure to stay in the present and just take my time. And I talked to my assistant coach. It's a conversation I'll never forget, Coach Dar. And, you know, even though it might be a little cliche, it was pretty simple. It was, you know, he was telling me I won 6 times in college in 1 year. And he goes, even though it's a different level, he goes, you've proven already just by being in the lead that you can play out here with these guys and you know how to win because you've done it so much in college. So go out there and winning, you know, at the PGA Tour level in college, it might be a little different, but winning is winning and you know how to close the deal. And that was the mindset that I had pretty much the entire day. And it worked out pretty well.
Okay, now then we go to Wingfoot, going back into the fall, and obviously, you know, you're leading by two. How do you process that now, or how do you process that going back to Sunday at Torrey, where, you know, on one hand you finished second at the U.S. Open, on the other hand you didn't play nearly as well as you wanted to, and that third hole really kind of started a little bit of a spiral. Like, how does that affect you going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if any of that is negative, really. I mean, obviously, I know I came in second and didn't win, or but in, you know, the way I look at it is, I'm so young and I've only played in a few majors, and I've already performed in all those and put myself in that situation to come down the stretch and play well. And, you know, even though, yeah, I might have not closed it out at, you know, Wingfoot or had a great round at the U.S. Open at Torrey, you know, at the PGA Championship, I was 4 or 5 behind and I shot 65 the last round to top 5. So, I mean, there's sometimes, you know, it's your day and you're playing well, and sometimes it's not and things just don't go your way. And, you know, it's just important to keep on putting yourself in those situations, because the more you do that, the more you're going to learn from it and be comfortable. And if I just keep on giving myself opportunities, I know one of these times, and it might not be soon, or it might be, you know, this year. I really don't know when it's going to happen, but I'm positive if I keep on putting myself in those situations, it's going to happen.
All right, you took 2 months off. Why and what did you do during those 2 months?
Yeah, I mean, the 2 months were definitely, I think it was just a little bit of a reset for me. I felt like I was playing pretty bad golf and was really hard on myself, getting really down on myself, and just wasn't enjoying the game. And I was going in some pretty dark places and, you know, it's not even, you know, before I even showed up for the week, just being like, why am I here? You know, just really bad, you know, just a bad place. And, you know, the first couple, I'd probably say month and a half, I really didn't even golf. I just was talking to the people closest to me and inside my circle and, you know, trying to just enjoy, you know, and be happy again, just enjoy life. And, you know, there's much more to golf than just, or there's much more to life than just golf. And I think that I was starting to play so much and not see the results that I wanted that I started to connect my happiness with my results. And, you know, it's great when it's going good, but it, you know, when it's going bad, it can get you in some pretty dark places. And I just made sure to care for myself and make sure I was happy and, you know, really put myself first for the first time in a little bit. And
how do you do that? Like at your age, I mean, I think what happens is all of us now, you know, when you get into your 30s or 40s, 50s, you're sitting there going like, man, I wish I had had this wisdom I have now. Back then, you're in your 20s, you're early 20s. How did you know that, like, I gotta get a break from this? How did you, did somebody recommend it to you? Was it something inside? Was there a sign? Like, what is it that tells you, like, I gotta walk away from a cup for a bit?
I mean, I think it was everything, like, a little bit combined. I mean, there's definitely people that, you know, have recommended it and been like, hey, if you're not enjoying the game, like, don't, you know, don't play. Like, you don't have to play. Look, you know, luckily I got the luxury of, you know, not luckily, but, you know, I won and now I have the luxury of having time to stay on tour and figure my, you know, my ups and downs out and get more acclimated out here. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have that time. And, but, you know, if you would have heard me, you know, people were telling me that and I would have been like, I can't do this. I can't just stop playing. Like, you can't just do that. Like, and that was where my head was at. You know, it's in the middle of the season. I'm not supposed to stop. I mean, everyone's playing here. No one's going to take time off. That's for the off season. I'll figure stuff out in the off season. But I really got to a point where I was, you know, I was just struggling, like even, you know, finding any confidence or even like wanting to go out there and play and like compete. Like my edge and my, you know, my enjoyment, my happiness with all involved, like around the game of golf just totally went away. And I was like, you know, even though I'm loving, you know, the life that I live and, you know, I make a lot of money or, you know, I have all these opportunities to travel and stuff like that, I know my happiness is more important than all that because, I mean, and to be honest, you know, I think that's really all that matters is you're happy and you're enjoying yourself. And, you know, it was a hard decision for sure, but I had the people around me support me through it. And, you know, it's definitely a worthwhile little break and feel like I'm in a much better spot now.
Okay, so you know, you finish tied for 15th at the U.S. Open. In the most honest answer you can give me, did you feel the joy of playing golf? Did you enjoy it, or did any of those feelings creep back in as tough as that course was the last couple of days?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I was definitely frustrated out there.
Difference, right, between being frustrated and, you know, depressed, right? There's a difference there, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's what I was trying to get to. Yeah. Like there are times that I was frustrated, but the feeling of frustration wasn't the feeling that I was having back in, you know, the last 4 or 5 months when I was playing golf, you know, that feeling of, like you said, depressed, sad, just like not even wanting to be there. That was a feeling that I was having, and I can absolutely say that there was no feeling that like that at all during the U.S. Open. And, you know, I felt like, to be honest, not only was there not a feeling like that, but I did play well. And most people, you know, might think, oh, well, obviously you're going to enjoy it if you're playing well. But even when I was having bad stretches of golf, even when I made a double, you know, that's the time where I'd usually get very mad and frustrated and kind of just like, you know, just a little down on myself, where as this week or the last week at the U.S. Open, I was very, you know, just like happy to be there and excited to compete, and no matter how the week went. And, you know, it's probably not a coincidence that as soon as I started being happy and enjoying it, I started playing well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I really, you know, I did not care about my score at all last week. And I still, it's great that I finished tied for 15th, but when, you know, I didn't even look at what I finished, honestly. The only reason I knew what I was at was because people were telling me. Like, I didn't even care what I finished. I was just so happy that I enjoyed myself and I, like, had fun out there, because that's literally the entire goal for last week, this week, next week. I mean, for the rest of my career, like, I'm just trying to have, you know, fun and enjoy it and be happy and, you know, be thankful for the life that I live.
Can I tell you the biggest mistake you made, though, this weekend?
What's that?
You didn't call me. I'll tell you why. Dan Beyer and I, we played the Farmers Insurance Open, the South Course. We won the Pro-Am there. What was that? Was that 2 years ago with CT Pan?
Yeah, we led CT Pan to victory, and then he won a few months later. So there was some.
I gave him a couple of tips.
Yeah.
I was telling him what he was doing with his hips. His hips were all screwed up. And we could have straightened you out. We could have really helped you get some course knowledge, you know. And we played, I think, 3 years in a row. We won it on the South Course. Two other people play in the North. And, no, you know, we're Oklahoma State guys. We're Southern California guys. Not one call, not one text. Listen, I mean, all this other stuff is great, but you gave away an advantage that you had, and it was like a layup. It was like Ben Simmons this past weekend. He turned out an absolute layup. That's what you did.
Well, you know what? It's all about learning, isn't it? I'm still learning, so you know what? I'm glad that I can put my head down at night on the pillow and say that I learned something today.
Okay, good, good.
That's the text you or call you next time.
Okay, listen, I played the Pro-Am at River Highlands. I've never won it. I do have some course knowledge. I'll share it with you off air. And that way, when you win Sunday, you can go like, listen, there's lots of people I want to thank, but Doug Gottlieb straightened me out. He told me about the seventh hole, little trick to the seventh hole, and and it's what turned me around. And listen, we're so happy that you're feeling better about playing golf. We love watching you, and it's always brave to say these things and to go through what you've gone through in a very, very public forum. It's awesome. And hope all is well. And kick Hunter's ass, would you? Because, I mean, he just, the level of arrogance winning that tournament one time, we just can't take it.
I'll do my best to humble him. Don't worry.
Right.
But yeah, I appreciate you having me on the show and those kind words. And yeah, just thank you again for having me.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
You know, it's always interesting to me on how Matthew Wolf kind of nailed something there, and it actually relates to a lot of different things that we cover. Dan Beyer, I know for people who don't know, Dan, obviously kind of our golf guru, he went down to Torrey on Friday, and you can hear his show on weekends. You're on Fox Sports Radio. Were you able to listen to Matthew Wolf, who joined us earlier?
Yeah, and I knew it was a bit of a topic. It was talked about at Torrey, and even some players were weighing in on it. But yeah, so I was able to hear his comments.
Tell me your takeaway.
I mean, absolutely refreshing, and to have someone so willingly talk about the struggles that they had and the lack of passion that they had for that game for a guy who's what, 22 years old?
Yes.
Was amazing. And you can tell just in the interview on how well liked he is and what a good young man he is. But to have that sort of wherewithal and presence and to understand what he needed to do for himself is, I don't think, in a lot of people that age.
Well, there's a similarity there to him and tennis player
Naomi Osaka,
right? Naomi Osaka. Now, Naomi's had more success, obviously, but similar age, right? And she, you know, she needed to take time away. My issue with Naomi Osaka was not all that. It was that, like, she was like kind of, at first, she's kind of blaming the media. Like, look, you have something going on, take all the time you need. Like, we get it. So maybe it's something about their generation where they kind of, they get it, right? Like, I'll give you an example. My son left for summer camp today. Not basketball camp, like summer camp. One that he's gone to for, I think this is the fifth summer that he's gone to. And, I mean, he's been hooping hardcore. I mean, even when things were shut down, we were playing in warehouses and wherever. You know, like, he's been all about it. And he was just like, look, I want a break. Not necessarily from basketball, like just everything going on. Like, I just want to be with a bunch of boys in a cabin and not have somewhere I got to be, you know? I was like, dude, I get it. And I didn't have that when I was 12. I couldn't do that, you know? I just, whatever somebody said to be, that's where I was. It's actually, I think one of the hard things about being an athlete is you're so used to somebody telling you what to do, where to do it, and how to do it, right? Then you get done playing, you're like, okay, now what do I do? You go to the gym, you're like, I have no motivation to work out. I don't want to. I had to be forced to do it for so long. Even if I love my sports, all the other stuff, right? But there was something that he said, or a bunch of things that he said are interesting. We'll play back for you. What part do you have? I don't even know what you guys... Oh, here's his first answer when we were talking about him stepping away from golf for 2 months.
I think it was just a little bit of a reset for me. I felt like I was playing pretty bad golf and was really hard on myself, getting really down on myself, and just wasn't enjoying the game. And I was going in some pretty dark places, and it's not even, you know, before I even showed up for the week, just being like, why am I here? You know, just really bad, you know, just a bad place. And, you know, the first couple, I'd probably say month and a half, I really didn't even golf. I just was talking to the people closest to me and inside my circle and, you know, trying to enjoy, you know, and be happy again, just enjoy life. And, you know, there's much more to life than just golf. And I think that I was starting to play so much and not see the results that I wanted that I started to connect my happiness with my results. And, you know, it's great when it's going good, but when it's going bad, it can get you in some pretty dark places.
And so that last part is really interesting. I mean, the whole thing is interesting. Okay. I'm not trying to understand. Like, the whole thing is like, you, what am I doing here? I'm not going to win. Why am I here? Right. So there's a little bit of, I mean, I think the common term used to be burnout, right? But the part at the end that was interesting to me, and it relates to like legacies that we establish for NBA players based upon playoff success, is we're so result oriented, right? Like, who was the best player in the Nets Bucks series? It was Kevin Durant, and it wasn't particularly close. No, he did not make the last shot he took. Matter of fact, it was an air ball, and they lost. He couldn't make a shot. He turned it over at times in overtime. Like, all of those things. If we're result-oriented, you're like, the result was they lost. Process-oriented is like, look what they were able to do despite the fact that didn't have Kyrie, didn't have Harden half the series, didn't have Spencer Dinwiddie at all. Like, all these things they didn't have. I had actually a great discussion with one of my parents of one of my kids I coach in AU basketball. He's 12. And that team lost a game in a tournament where they were down one and he made one of two free throws. Forced overtime, they lost in overtime. And I said, you know, did you talk about the miss or did you talk about the make? And they're like, well, we talked about both. And I was like, well, that's fine. I was like, but it's important to point out that he missed the first, he made the second. That second one's way harder to make if you miss the first. So even though it's you may think, hey, your son could have won us the game and we lost because he missed a free throw. The fact was, it wouldn't have gone overtime had he not made the second free throw. But I look at this, the NBA stuff, and I'm like, okay, so is Chris Paul a better player now than he was before they beat the Lakers? Like, look, they weren't beating the Lakers if Anthony Davis was healthy. I don't believe they're beating the Lakers. And I'm not totally convinced they're beating the Nuggets if Jamal Murray is healthy. Now, neither of those things happened, and they did, in fact, advance, and now they're up one game to none. I think Chris Paul is great, whether he wins a title when he doesn't win a title. But isn't it interesting that somehow now, like, he'll break through some invisible barrier if they win a championship, knowing full well they didn't play a healthy Lakers. They're playing the Clippers without their best player. They're not going to get the most talented team in the East in the Nets. And we'll see who they play in the finals. But if he wins, nobody cares. It's we're result-oriented, which is exactly what Matthew Wolf was talking about. You can't be result-oriented in sports because there's just too much failure in it. Too much failure. And I think there's a certain level of brilliance, and there's a certain understanding of how the world works if you can focus on process instead of result. Here's some more Matthew Wolf.
If you would have heard me, you know, people were telling me that, and I would have been like, I can't do this. I can't just stop playing. Like, you can't just do that. Like, and that was where my head was at. You know, it's in the middle of the season. I'm not supposed to stop. I mean, everyone's playing here. No one's going to take time off. That's for the off season. I'll figure stuff out in the off season. But I really got to a point where I was just struggling, like even finding any confidence or even like wanting to go out there and play and like compete. Like my edge and my, you know, my enjoyment, my happiness all involved like around the game of golf just totally went away. And I was like, you know, even though I'm loving, you know, the life that I live and, you know, I make a lot of money or, you know, I have all these opportunities to travel and stuff like that, I know my happiness is more important than all that.
And look, we kind of as people have to figure all that out, right? Like we have to figure out how we can find that same balance as people. It's a very, very difficult thing to find. And here's, you know, Matthew Wolf, 22 years old, who's figured out it's about result, not about process. I mean, it's about process, not about result. It's a pretty fantastic thing. And I think we should look at that in how we look at some of these athletes. Right? How we look at some of these athletes. We have to look at it that way. We cannot look at it who won and who lost. How'd you play?
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Hey, it's Ben, host of the Fifth Hour with Ben Maller, along with my trusty sidekick, David Gascon. Would mean a lot to have you join us on our weekly auditory journey. You're asking, what in God's name is the Fifth Hour? I'll tell you, it's a spinoff of the Ben Maller Show, a cult hit overnights on FSR. Why should you listen? Picture, if you will, a world where we chat with captains of industry in media, sports, and more every week. Explore some amazing facts about human nature and more. Listen to the Fifth Hour with Ben Maller on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Let's welcome in Mike Sando. He joins us on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. I didn't really thought of that. Remember when guys had the camera on in the locker room and got some of it? I mean, imagine if that happened in an NFL team meeting anyway.
Hopefully it's one of those things which is really weird. Like, is some of this telling? It's very telling. It's very telling. On the other hand, like, look, part of the nature of being a coach is you have to be connected but slightly disconnected. You can't, you know, you can't be huggy and feely with everybody. You know, you got to coach. But the idea that you would record a conversation with your coach
in context, you know, you could easily, because everyone on a team has a beef about something, right? I mean, we don't do it all the way that every player wants to do it, right?
Yes.
So everyone has a thing they think should be done differently. So, man, hopefully you put the team first.
it's going to be very, very interesting. Mike Sando works for The Athletic. He's the Football GM podcast. And what's your guess on who Tom Brady was talking about when he was on, what was it called, The Shop, Ramos? We have that? He was on The Shop. And he had this to say about one of the teams he was considering going to in free agency.
One of the teams, and they weren't interested at the very end. I was thinking, you're sticking with that mother.
Okay, so here are the teams that are possible, right? Tampa, but he went there, so it ain't them. Miami. Let's see here. There's the Bears. There's the Chargers. There's the Raiders. There's the Niners. And that's what I got. Am I missing any other teams?
Some of my – so I'm going to tell you – I'll tell you up front that, to me, the Titans are the most logical one. But
Titans?
Like, to me, the Chargers don't fit. They drafted Herbert. I mean, there's no expectation. The Colts don't fit because they didn't stick with anybody. They went and got Rivers, who I'm sure Brady respects, even though he knows he's better than Rivers. That's a respectable decision. You know, the Raiders could fit. They stuck with Carr. But, you know, the Bears certainly with Trubisky. I don't know how deep they were in the end. The 49ers could be Garoppolo. But Brady and Garoppolo share the same agent. I don't think that he would be exasperated to find out what the 49ers are going to do. Wouldn't he have a good feel for that? So for me, the Titans make sense because they were the team that actively re-upped with their guy, right? I mean, they could have gone in another direction and decided before, if I remember, before free agency, didn't they do a new deal with Tannehill?
They did.
And so, to me, that would be the team that stuck with them. If we're just parsing the words that are said, right? I mean, it's a really quick snippet. That would fit the criteria the most to me. And you could also see him speaking that way, frankly, with someone like Mike Vrabel, right? Who's kind of a contemporary, you know, a buddy of his. And organizationally, they may have said, hey, you know what? We got a good thing going with Ryan here. We don't want it to start over. We're going to do this. Couldn't you see Brady going, you're going to stick with, you know, that sort of thing? So, I don't know. Do you buy that? I mean, that's just tea leaves a little bit.
I take the Niners. Because I, you know, look, he clearly had an issue with Jimmy G trying to take his job. And he saw how poorly Jimmy G played in the second half of the Super Bowl. They considered it. And the Niners supposedly are ones that they kicked the tires and like, yeah, we're good. We're going to stay put. I think it's the Niners.
Oh, and the 49ers make a ton of sense because that we know that's where he really wanted to always go his whole career. So, yeah, I would buy that. If I had to bet it, I would say the 49ers. I agree with you on 49ers.
I flipped you. I flipped him. I flipped. Mike Sando has flipped to orange. He joins us here on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. I saw where you and a couple others, you had to predict what would happen with Aaron Rodgers. You predicted he would report before training camp starts or before training camp ended?
I kind of think he'd report before the season. You know, that's sort of where I'm at. I think that he wants to punish them, and he's taking delight in doing that. And I think that they're an old-school team that's probably not going to finesse it to get him back sooner. But in the end, I think his ability to – I think he'll push it as far as he can without hurting his legacy. And so to me, it just makes the most sense for everybody to trade him next offseason. They can maximize the value. They can know the picks, the order of the draft. They can have a better feel for what they've got in their guy if Jordan Love does have to play. And it's probably easier for Rodgers to have some input too, because teams, let's face it, right now it's harder to clear the decks and bring in a big salary, change to a new quarterback, all of that. So that's why I'm kind of betting that he eventually comes in, and this is it for him in Green Bay after this year.
It's Doug Gottlieb's show here on Fox Sports Radio. Regardless of how it goes?
Regardless of how the season goes?
Yes.
No, I mean, look, if he's the MVP again, right, they're going to be in the same conundrum, and who knows? You know, would they potentially give up on Jordan Love? I don't know. But I think it's very strongly, I would lean very strongly to this being his last year.
Do you think, and I know you know the Seahawks so well, my working hypothesis is that among the things that upset Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers is not just that they didn't get to a Super Bowl, but that Tom Brady did, right? And it's like, look, Tom Brady, I mean, Antonio Brown only worked out with two different guys, Tom Brady and Russell Wilson, and I'm guessing Seattle's like, yeah, we can't really do that. Right, just too much baggage, can't do it. And Aaron Rodgers, you shake hands with that guy and you're like, are you kidding me? I lost to this guy. I think that Tom Brady is a and his success is a big portion of why they're so upset with their current franchises.
You know, I think that is a tipping point. I think it pushed Wilson over the edge because he came out right after the Super Bowl. There's no question he was at the Super Bowl sitting there watching it. So I don't think that I think he carried these feelings into it, but that it all came to a flashpoint then. I don't think the Seattle organization nixed him on Antonio Brown, though. I think Antonio Brown used Russell Wilson, used the Seahawks to get Tampa Bay to move, and that's where he was going all along. He was actually in Tampa Bay when he was talking to Seattle, was my understanding. So I don't think that was necessarily a trigger, but it was symbolic of just adding on to this idea that Tom Brady, frankly, has been rubbing in everybody's face, too. Ah, it's great. Love it here with Bruce Arians. And then Bruce Arians is even like, oh, yeah, we give Tommy a tape of all the guys that are coming out of the draft. He's great. Like he's really picking the players, right? I mean, but they're like playing into this. I think it's driving the other guys nuts.
It really is driving the other guys nuts, and also keeping some of these guys playing because they see his success late and they think, well, if he can do it, I can do it.
Absolutely. I mean, imagine any of us that have, you know, your peers, and if the other people that do what you do were getting all these things that you wanted and flaunting it in your face, you'd have some feelings, right? And if you happen to make $35 million a year, you might verbalize those feelings and feel like, you know, dang it, make it happen. This should be for me.
Mike Sando joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. You know, I saw this that obviously the news yesterday was that Carl Nassib came out as gay. And I feel like we've reached the point where it's not that big a story. I mean, it is and it isn't. I just and honestly, I almost feel like if you led with it and made a big, that actually is the counter to what we want the ultimate reality to be, which is, hey, it's okay. We keep playing football. Not a big deal. Personal preference. In your mind, and you know this game a lot better than I do, and you've been covering it a lot longer, do you think we've reached that point to where it's a story, but not that big a story?
I do think that it is a big deal that it's not a bigger deal. But I don't think that I, at least personally, can fully appreciate or even articulate what it really does mean to someone who might be under tremendous stress about something that's fundamental to their identity, but is concealed from the public and even their loved ones out of fear. So think of it from that person's standpoint. This is huge. And so to the extent that we can appreciate what that means to them, I think it informs our opinion then of how big it really is. And I think with most things like this, you know, you bridge the otherness by knowing who it is. And so when this is happening, you know, there's nobody attacking Carl Nassib, right? Because he's known to be a good dude and he's a good football player and everybody likes him. So it immediately put a face to something, I think, in a really good and positive way. And the reaction has been positive, and hopefully this helps somebody who really needs the help, right?
Yeah. I think that's the point that he was making, and it's a good one. And I do think that we're in a pretty good place where it's not nearly as big a thing as it may have been previously. But I don't know if it feels that way to people who are gay who have yet to come out. I don't know that for a fact. Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Mike Sando is our guest. Covers the NFL for The Athletic, of course. Covered the Seahawks for years. This is not his first rodeo. Okay, we're kind of in this lull spot before it gets real. Are we taking into account enough how different the season may look with a 17th game? Stick with me for a second. It's not just that they're adding another game. A lot of these games are like made for TV games. So you're adding another game and you're adding another very, very competitive game for the elite teams. Do you think that we have any true understanding yet of what that does to the teams once we get to the 18th game, which is the playoffs?
No, but I think it's probably overrated if we think it's a huge deal. I mean, just go back. I mean, the seasons used to be 12 games, 14 games, 16 games. I don't remember. Like, when I talk to people who played in the 70s, they're not like, well, you know, it was once we changed to 16 games in 78, I mean, that really changed everything. You know, I think for most of us, it changes, okay, what does a 1,000-yard season mean? You know, those sorts of things. But certainly for some players, it's going to be more of wear and tear. But players are also doing less than they used to do. It's a much more specialized game. There's guys playing only a handful of snaps in some cases. Obviously, no one's going, you know, two ways, or your starters aren't playing a ton of special teams even necessarily. In a lot of cases, there's not two-a-day practices. The off seasons are being pushed back against. I think they maybe did get to be too much. You know, so I think there's ways that it evens out. And look, just to play football now means you're not going to be absolutely knocked unconscious repeatedly during the season because the hitting isn't what it used to be either. So I think it balances out in its own way, and it'll be okay.
It's Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. We haven't really seen anything like what Tampa's looking like. Their whole team is back, and it's going to be fascinating. Are we sure they're going to be better?
Well, I think we're sure they're going to be good, and we don't really know if they're going to win the Super Bowl because, not that it's a random thing, but, I mean, what are the odds that they would win it last year, right? I mean, even the exact same team, if they played last season five times, do they win the Super Bowl once, twice? Well, that's pretty darn good odds if you're winning it 40% or 20% of the time of your chances, but it doesn't mean that if you're 5% better the next year that you happen to win it, right? It still may only be a 10 or 15% chance that they win it. So there's no question in my mind that they should be better offensively over the course of the whole year of just cohesiveness and figuring it out. They were better the second half. They're going to add a couple. They got the running back situation, I think, set up better to facilitate Brady. So I think they're going to be just as good with just as good of a chance of winning the Super Bowl. But just remember, last year it wasn't 100% chance they won it. It's only 100% chance in retrospect after they won it. So that's kind of how I see it.
Mike, great stuff. Awesome catching up with you. Thanks so much for your perspective.
Thank you.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Rick Bucher joins us. Buke, okay, so first thing on Ben Simmons is poorly kept secret, not really a worker. And, you know, I read an article last night from FoxSports.com where apparently when Brett Brown was there, they had a shooting coach to spend every day with him in the summer. And then Rich Paul came and was like, nah, he's going to work with his brother. And it got worse, not better. How much of the work ethic has been discussed in NBA circles?
Oh, I think it's pretty well understood that, I mean, look, the evidence is right there. He had the opportunity the first year when he broke the bone in his foot to begin working on a shot that he didn't have in college at LSU. You know, the warning sign already was at LSU, you can't, you're a number one pick and you can't get your team to the NCAA tournament. We've now 5 years in and it has not changed. It is the one thing that's just perplexing for people that I haven't been able to get an answer to is why not? Like what, as you know, first of all, being able to shoot, being able to knock down shots is one of the most rewarding things that you can have in the game. It's fun to shoot. There's things working on footwork, working on post moves, like that stuff can be grinding. Shooting is fun. I don't know that there's anything better or more enjoyable than to get up shot. And so that's the part that is most perplexing to me and most people in the league, which is just the reluctance or the refusal to develop something that is so critical to the game. And I wish I had an answer for you, but I've asked that question to plenty of people in the league and nobody's given me a reasonable one yet.
Okay. Do you think they commit to trying to fix it, or do you think they move on from it?
I would say that they're going to try to move on. It's a matter of what can you get for them? Can you find somebody who is willing to take that on? And I would dare say there's probably a better chance that you're going to find somebody who's willing to take it on than to fix it. The other problem is at this point that you've already developed your team in a way that is built not to have him shoot. You're already presuming that that's not part of the equation. So you've added pieces and you've paid for pieces to put shooters around him. And it's not that it wouldn't help that he had a shot, but where are you going to find those shots now, or where are you going to be able to experiment with him in developing a shot? That's really the great tragedy here, is that the opportunity was there early on when they weren't trying to win. There's no better opportunity than to shoot and shoot away and not worry about the pressure of having to go deep into the playoffs or win a championship. Now the parameters are completely different. The pressure is on everybody in Philadelphia to make good on trying to win a ring while Joel Embiid is still healthy. Otherwise, you're going back to the drawing board having accomplished nothing. And at this point, nobody in Philadelphia wants to do that.
Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Becky Hammon is one of the finalists, but so too now is Mike D'Antoni and is Chauncey Billups. Some of this is some help from people in the league. Some of this is intuition, right? You have Paul Allen's sister running the team.
Yep.
She seems like she wants Becky Hammon.
Yep.
And the basketball people are like, yeah, I don't think that keeps us in the Damian Lillard business or gets us closer to a championship.
Right. I've heard the exact same thing. My understanding is that Jody Allen is really enamored with hiring Becky. I think there's a lot of circumstances where the idea of hiring Becky, being the first team to hire a woman head coach, is appealing from, and I don't mean this as a slight, because I think that Becky is a good coach, but as a trend-setting statement by a team. But it would be with any unproven head coach. The idea of hiring them when you believe that you are in the business of trying to win a championship or trying to keep a superstar happy, that going and hiring a young, unproven star, coach is not the answer. So I understand where the battle is. Now, my other understanding, too, is that Jody Allen is interested in selling the team. A number of people have taken a run at purchasing it. I've been told that it's going to happen sooner rather than later, but I have not been able to identify who the new purchaser might be. Some of the guys from Robinhood were interested and took a run at it. My understanding is that didn't come to fruition, and so I don't know who is next in line in terms of getting that done. But that's throwing a little bit of a wrinkle in here in this situation as well, which is what's the timing of the transfer of or the sale of the team, and how does that timeline fit with hiring a new head coach?
Correct. It makes it trickier. Let's get to the teams that are still remaining. Why are the Clippers not telling us that Kawhi is done for the year?
Boy, I don't know. Unless it's just gamesmanship, you know, simply trying to keep the Suns guessing in terms of what they have to prepare for. Do we have to prepare for sets in which Kawhi would be playing? It just takes up a little more time, leaves a little more of a question in everybody's head. That's the only reason that I can see for doing that, because considering everything that I've heard and know about the extent of the injury, the idea of him coming back and playing right now seems to be pretty remote. Other than trying to get some sort of competitive advantage, I don't know. And I'm a little bit surprised that the league has not required a little more transparency in terms of where he stands. I want to say that this is not the first time that this has happened in recent memory where we were uncertain about when someone was going to come back and that the timeline kept shifting. And we went through that with Anthony Davis for a bit during the regular season, but that was the regular season, and the postseason is a lot different.
It is really, really weird. Ty Lue has been outstanding as his ability to find mismatches. It's taken him a couple. Do you like this? You know, the old expression in the NBA is a playoff series doesn't begin until the road team wins a game. I think the new expression should be a Clippers series doesn't start until they're down 0-2.
Well, I do. You know, look, I've been impressed with his confidence in his roster and his willingness to make changes. I have been surprised at how methodical he has been in doing it. I was surprised in the Utah series that he didn't start playing small sooner, because, and I know he started Batum, but he went to Zubac and he played DeMarcus Cousins early on. And seeing them in the regular season, I thought that's what was going to be most effective. I do think that one of the advantages of doing it the way that he has is that, the durability of the team has been extended. You know, he's getting minutes from a lot of different guys. And so we haven't seen, other than Kawhi, we haven't seen guys breaking down or fatigue, you know, getting fatigued. And so that has helped. I will be very interested to see how he approaches this particular game. But, the reality is, I think they could have won game one. And while DeAndre Ayton and how you match up with him and do you play Zubac and or Cousins is a question, I really think it comes down to Paul George. You're not Kevin Durant. Everybody keeps saying he has to dominate. When he was at his best in these playoffs so far, it's been as a rebounder, as a defender, initiate the offense. But when he's going ISO, I don't really like what they get. I think they get too stagnant when it's give him the ball on the pinch post, and then just wait to see where he can go, and we'll play off of that. I don't think that's them at their best. So Reggie Jackson not trying to do too much. Paul George getting back to the way he played against the Utah Jazz. I think if you get that, you have enough for the Clippers at least to win game two, and we'll see how we go from there.
Rick Bucher is our guest in the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Why do I not think the Atlanta Hawks have a legitimate chance to win this thing, win the East?
I don't know, because I feel as if I haven't been overwhelmed by the way Mike Budenholzer has coached. The six-man rotation, I mean, again, what we've seen so far is that depth and versatility has been the hallmark. Now, what are the matchups are going to be, and, you know, what's Drew Holiday? I would have hoped that Drew Holiday is more effective on Trey than Ben Simmons was at the end of that series. I also think that Atlanta has more guys to guard in this series than they did in the last one. I understand why your hesitation might be there with Atlanta, because it feels like they found teams that were just lesser than them in various ways, or that they had an antidote that the other teams lost as much as the Hawks won. But that said, I have my questions about the Bucks too in the same regard. And so I feel like they might be able to steal another series. I have the Bucks winning. I have a Bucks-Clippers finals. I've had it since the beginning of the year. But I just haven't been impressed with how Bud has utilized his roster or how he has utilized matchups. I think you're going to need to see some Bobby Portis in this series. I think you're going to need to see Bryn Forbes get back to shooting the way we've seen him shoot at previous times prior to the previous series. So, if those things happen, then I think that then the Bucks win. But I don't think the Bucks are foolproof by any means, and so I think they could be as vulnerable to the Hawks as the Sixers and the Knicks were.
Oh, I agree there. Like I thought the Nets were, obviously, if they're healthy, I thought they were a lot better than the Bucks. The problem is they weren't healthy. That's really the story of this postseason is he who's the healthiest. It seems to be able to survive the longest.
And that's why I don't like this whole, you got to have a big three, you got to be top heavy. I'm not convinced that that's actually been the blueprint for the last few years. I don't think it was what made the Lakers so good in the bubble. It was that they were getting contributions from Dwight Howard and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Kyle Kuzma and Alex Caruso. And yes, AD and LeBron were special, but you know, they got contributions from a lot of different places. The Toronto Raptors got contributions from a lot of different places. I would say that the Warriors with KD, those 2 years were the when a top-heavy team won it. But other than that, early Warriors was not that. I think we're in a different place. You have to have a closer, a superstar who forces mismatches, for sure. But the concept of a big three as being the winning formula, for that very thing, because if you get one injury, then you don't have a big three. And if you're riding a big three, chances are one of those pieces is going to get injured before you get to the finish line.
Yep. Be great stuff, man. Thanks so much for joining us.
You got it, Doug.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.